website with just a little bit of background, if you could just talk about where you grew up and where you went to school.
Okay, I was born in Bloomington, Illinois. My folks were from downstate Illinois. I wasn't in Bloomington long, and the family moved up to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And when I was about four, they moved into the suburbs. So I was really more of a suburban kid. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Lombard. Pretty lucky to have had a really good family.
Yeah.
You know, a nice, loving family. So basically grew up in that house all my life. 50s and 60s, an interesting time, totally different to today. I mean, I knew nothing compared to what kids today know. Mm-hmm. And then went to college in Iowa, just happened to pick a small school, Simpson College, studied history and politics and kind of general liberal arts thing. Was lucky to get a fellowship to graduate school. I intended to go to law school, but I got this fellowship, so I went to Case Western Reserve in Cleveland in American Studies. Mm-hmm. Where I spent 2 years, picked up an MA, never finished the PhD, was studying all the stuff about American history. It was now 1968. In my view, the world was coming apart. I became much more an activist, and I guess I wondered what I was still doing in school. And, so I basically left Case Western partly because I fell into an accidental teaching job, historically speaking, because in 1968, when I was if I had gone to my third year of graduate school, I would have stayed exempt from military. I mean, this was the high point of the Vietnam War. By this time, I was a severe critic of the war, so I took a lot of risks by not going back to the third year of graduate school where I would have been exempt. And what happened was that a nun, not a BVM. I didn't know anything about nuns. I was not raised Catholic. Didn't have a clue, except those were the kids in the other corner that had these uniforms and went to a different school on a different bus. As much as I knew about Catholic, so to speak. So this nun from an order who was in one of my classes in graduate school stopped me one day and said, would you be interested in teaching at our college history and American history and American politics. And like I was saying, I was in graduate school, but I was in some ways more of an activist than a student. I'd gotten very involved in a guy named Carl Stokes, who became the first black mayor of Cleveland in 1967. I liked graduate school. I had a pretty good deal, but I guess I was looking for something a little more dramatic. So I said yes, and what happened is the teacher who was the professor at this small school called Notre Dame College in the Cleveland area had been called up in the Pueblo incident, which was an incident off the coast of Asia someplace in that way. Anyway, he was in the reserves. We got called up, and so anyway, I decided to do that. So in the fall of 69, I left Chicago to go to Cleveland, and I went to go historically. I left before the, I'm sorry, 68, in 68, before the Democratic Convention and all the stuff that happened, because otherwise I'm sure I would have been there.
Right.
But since they started school early, I had left to go out there in mid-August.
So you were home for the summer then from Case Western, and you just went back to Ohio to take the job?
Yes, I came home in the summers of, when I was in graduate school, it was fall of 66 to 68, I guess. And both those summers of 67 and 68, I came back, which is very relevant to Mundelein. Because my connection to Mundelein, again, was all accidental, too, which much of life is accidental. I was finishing my first year of graduate school in Cleveland, which would have been, let's say, May of 1967. Looking for a summer job, heard about Upward Bound, applied to various places in Cleveland for the Upward Bound program, which is a federally funded program to help educate high school kids, kind of like the equivalent of Head Start for high school age kids.
Okay.
Couldn't get a job there. Someone said to me, well, why don't you apply for Upward Bound in Chicago, because that's where you're from. I did. I applied several places, and I got this letter back from one of the nuns at Mundelein. It's my first experience. I didn't know underlined from a hole in the wall. Very interesting letter, and I think, I don't remember if it came from Sister Kathleen O'Brien or Sister Margaret Thornton, but one of the sisters who worked with Upward Bound and the History Department wanted to line the letter was something like this, because I thought I'd be what they called like a counselor, and I didn't know, you know, which was a men-only, women-only school. And those were like, you know, graduate school kids that worked with the students.
Right.
And the letter came back is, we looked at your resume, we've seen you had a lot of American history and so forth. We're looking for someone who could teach 50, 60 high-risk young girls from the ghetto, so to speak,
right,
teach them about American history and so forth. And so I worked really hard on that. In fact, I wish I still had. I worked on it, you know, for my, you know, 21-year-old kid, kind of come up with creative ideas how to teach history that you thought was more meaningful than the stuff you've been getting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I had some great profs who were very boring, I guess is the way I put it. And so I wrote that back, and they hired me sight unseen.
For this Upward Bound program.
Yes. And so my experience with Mundelein was that not as a college teacher, but as this program that was taking place at Mundelein College. So I did that in the summers of 1967, 68, and 69. And that was a marvelous experience. And talk about, I mean, your things, talk about teaching experiences. Mundelein was a great experience for me at the college level, and the experimental college, the weekend college, the returning students, the whole shebang was pretty exciting for me. This Upward Bound was a knockout.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful experience.
What about it made it wonderful?
The kids were wonderful. The nuns who organized at Mundelein were what I call the kind of progressive bunch who were willing to experiment, willing to, you know, when you're taking maybe a 16-year-old kid from the ghetto, in which most of their classmates would never go on to college and so forth, I mean, how do you make them more interested in whether or not Abraham Lincoln did this or that? And I remember one experience, I mean, because we had the ability to experiment. I remember one, it was small in the sense, and we, it was like we weren't caught up with a lot of red tape, which is a big problem for most teachers, you know, with public schools, and in a lesser sense in universities, but it's still there. And so one, I remember one thing that we often did, and I guess because I was young, it was easy to do these experiments. I don't know where I copied them from somebody else. But I remember one class in which we were trying to get across what, you know, what eyewitness testimony was. It had something to do with American history experience. Three students from another class came into our room and basically tore up the room intentionally.
Physically?
Well, what they did is they came in and they picked up some chalk and threw it, picked up a couple of erasers and threw it, actually pushed, this is all women now, pushed a couple of their colleagues, I mean, not a fist fight,
right,
ran in, were probably in and out of the room in less than 20 seconds. And the experience was, is then we asked the people who were in the classroom, okay, to identify who it was. And of course, the experience, which was interesting, all which was historically valuable, is that they couldn't, and they misidentified, even racially.
Mm-hmm.
They misidentified black for white. And so the experience was that, you know, people could go to their death for a misidentification or something. And I'm just giving an example. It was a good experience because it was a whole experience. It was, again, it wasn't just some people that came together once a week for 3 hours. It was every day, fairly intense, and you were teacher, counselor, advisor, and everything. And I also remember that it was that first year in 1967 that they had this big trip at the end of the summer for the kids that we all went along with. And this was the faculty, and there was about 20 or 30 Mundelein students who served as tutor counselors, because the kids lived in the dorm with the college women, who were kind of like advisors. And it was a very well done program, and a very good program that unfortunately has not been, it's not totally out. It just hasn't, there's a lot of cutbacks financially.
How,
I was just about to say real quickly is that summer we finished up by going to Washington, D.C., where the kids got to actually meet with Robert Kennedy.
Really?
This was a year before he was assassinated. But anyway, so that was my first experience at Mundelein, which was so good because my teaching experience in Cleveland had been with a very conservative, almost right-wing reactionary group of sisters. And so we did not leave a good impression. Lots of stories that you probably would be interested in. So then to be experienced with the BVMs, for someone like who wasn't Catholic and did not have the wealth of the breadth of knowledge about either nuns or Catholics or whatever, a very good experience to see these Catherine O'Briens and the Margaret Thorntons and the others that participated in this program. So to tie that together, that's how I got hired to be a faculty member at Mundelein, because a year later, I did that teaching year that I started without at Notre Dame College. A year later, they needed a history faculty. In fact, I think it was maybe when Prudence Moreland went off, when went to study or travel or something. And so, again, I think it was Kathleen O'Brien who was really behind it, who has since left the order, but they hired me to be the full-time history faculty at Mundelein. So that brought me to Mundelein in the fall of 69, not just in the summer program, which was just held at Mundelein,
right,
but actually to be Mundelein faculty. So that's how these things work out.
You referred to the Progressive Bunch.
Yeah.
Were there individual people that you would point to, or do you think that...
Well, I think a lot of the folks around, particularly in terms of the sisters, a lot of the folks around the Weekend College, Mary Griffin, who passed, Mary DeCook, who were interested in what you might say in educational, progressive educational theory, and how do you achieve the substance that is necessary? How do you make sure that students have a certain knowledge of content of the subject area so they can succeed? But also tries to deal, I guess, with a little more experimental with motivational techniques. Everybody is concerned about it. There's always that tension. It's not all black and white. But there's always that tension there. And Mundelein, long before I got there, was always experimenting. When I first came in 69, they had a structure in which I was teaching like History 1, History 2, and we had 60 or 70 people in the classroom. And they experimented with team teaching. And so Mundelein was a place where I think one of the reasons it was known to be a good college with generally good faculty was because they took the teaching seriously. There wasn't the pressure to publish. I'm sure there's more of it today, and particularly as part of Loyola. And there's something to that. There's something to, in my view, it's very valuable for faculty to have the time to study more in their own field and learn. But there's something very valuable to understand that good teaching is every bit as valuable. In fact, it's more valuable in some cases to students than the individual scholarship of the professor. And so Mundelein, like I said, so bam, right from working at Mandela, working at the Upward Bound even before, it's kind of an introduction to Mundelein that proved to be experimental. Yes? Yes.
Okay. Did you want to add something else about the Upward Bound program, or can we move on to something?
Yeah, we can move on. Because there's too many things, and it will take up too much time. So.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the City in Crisis course that you launched.
Oh, yes.
That was in 1970.
Oh, man, there was so many great things. That was, it's hard to say which was the greatest, but that was a wonderful experience for me and a wonderful experience for the teachers. We basically copied something that some Loyola profs, and I think, in fact, Russ Barta had worked with somebody at Loyola and tried to do something like this, and I'm not sure why it didn't get off the ground. But so, again, they asked me to work on that, I think, as soon as I got there. And it was great for me because it's what I wanted to do. And what made it so successful, and by successful I mean that the students learned a lot and they loved it, was that it was more intense. It was not just, again, get together 3 hours. Because partly what I'm saying is that there's different ways to teach. And a really brilliant lecturer can offer an awful lot to students, even if it's a 3-hour or 1-hour segment. But the most real education goes way beyond that. Real education is befriending, is knowing someone so that what you can actually say to a student is, I care about you, you're a good person, you really gotta pay attention to this because you just don't get it. Okay, and it would just, you have to develop a certain amount of personal relationship where you can go beyond, because most learning is not just memorizing dates and stuff. Most learning is deeper. It's how do I come to make decisions about life, analysis, the world. And in some ways, real learning is personal. These experiences, that, particularly at Mundelein, a lot of them, and my view, just in knowing some of the students and keeping in touch only with a few of them, that there's other experiences that related to some of these education experiments, or the fact that the political swirl around Mundelein, the strike in 1969, all that stuff were very valuable learning experiences. But back to this, so what was valuable about it, what it made it successful, it was intense. It was every day of the week, this is a summer school program, for 9 to 12. And in many cases, because people were available and I was available, it continued. So you might have class 9 to 12 and then go have lunch and keep talking, because the idea was experiential. The city in crisis, let's get to see it. So we would have many guests. Okay, we had John Stroger, who's now the county board president, would come in. We had Howard Saffold from the African American Patrolman's League. We went to the county jail. We went to city council. In fact, we were in the city council when the older Mayor Daley made his famous son speech, and there was almost a big riot in the city council, and he was very angry at young people and sat and stared at us for hours, being so angry at young in general, because that was the day Dick Simpson challenged him on the floor of the city council, which was, I believe, around 1969, I think. So we went all these places, met with community organizers and went to community groups. And so then the students had to analyze all these experiences and what people said and different opinions and so forth. So it was a very, very good experience. We did that, I think, for just about 10 summers.
So it was a yearly program for 10 summers?
Yeah. So like every summer, and like I said, what made it special was it was experiential and they had more time. And so the other thing is that the camaraderie, like I said before, learning can be personal. The camaraderie developed among the students every year was fascinating. Because in many cases what you had is older students, by that I mean, they might be 30s and 40s, younger students. You even had a spattering of males in there. And all the classes were exciting, but the class of 1975 had this fascinating young men, and the relationship developed between the 35, 40-year-old women. And I'm not talking about so much personal, in terms of just the exchanging of ideas. So anyway, it was a fun thing. People learned a lot. So,
and
it was great for me to learn a lot about politics in the city.
That was something that was in place before you came to Mundelein?
No, it had been an idea that there was a brochure that I think Loyola had talked about. And I don't think, let's put it like this, if it ever happened at Loyola, I'm not sure what happened with it, but it wasn't functioning when I got there. So what they did is they said, here's something we'd like to think about. And then I guess I pretty much looked at what they had done before and schemed something, like I said, which would be experiential. And I mean, a lot of people are doing this kind of thing. It's not so unique. Ours was unique in the sense that it had, like I say, this intense all-morning session, which in some cases led to 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Because quite a few of the classes, since this was their only class, because they were getting 6 hours credit, they could stick around.
Do you have any recollections of what was called CONCUR, the Conference on Curriculum?
I do. Again, just another example of what I see as Mundelein faculty's commitment to continuous reevaluation of what we're teaching and how best to go about that experience. I was involved in a lot of that stuff. And again, a positive experience. It seems like many of us who we were paid very little at Mundelein, but I started at $6,000, I think, in 1968, or fall of 69. Another one of those examples of people who were so committed to education and particularly teaching that they would take this, which you might call extra time, to bait these ideas. And there was always differing views, and I'm sure there was people that thought, people like me who came in at the Mundelein having a goatee, who started at Mundelein when I was probably about 24 years old and looked about 18. Many of my students looked older than me. And I'm sure many of the faculty felt, who is this dippy kid, you know, that knows nothing? But there was just, you know, there was like such a wonderful, you know, before I was talking about nuns who are progressive, I mean, you know, the people like Bill Hill, well, some of the others, Mike Fortune, and a lot of folks that I dealt with, just people that were just 100% committed. It didn't matter what they got paid. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter how many committees they had to sit on, how many classes they had to teach, which took them away from the personal research they would have liked to do. They were willing to do it. And so Conquer was just another example of that.
And what was the goal of Conquer?
Oh, that's been a while. I think the goal at that point was to review the curriculum and try and make changes. And again, what is the best thing that we can teach and the best way to go about teaching them? Trying to think of who the students were at that time in the early 70s. And, so I guess overall it was, I guess in theory, it was a curriculum reevaluation.
One of the things that came out of it was the experimental college. Do you have a role in shaping that, or do you know what the goals were?
All this stuff kind of fits together. Think of this, it's 1969, 70, 71. You've got, this is partly a reflection of the 60s. You've got students who are saying, why do I have to take these particular courses or in this particular order? I can learn better if you just let me do some of these things. Or maybe I shouldn't be great in all this stuff, because then I'm trying to focus on this rather than, it's the kind of thing that the poor students can use all the time to try and get out of work. But this time at Mundelein, what you really had was good students who were on the edge. As part of, remember, I recovered from the 60s. Good students who were on the edge of what you might say adulthood and progressivism, even radicalism, because all this swirl around them, you know, the civil rights swirl, the Vietnamese War, the youthful energy created by all that stuff, including the youthful disappointments and all the horrible things that were happening in 68, 69, 70. So you had that building, and I see Crosby, David Crosby, in the English faculty, was the kind of ringleader, and I was his sidekick, and I really can't remember if there were many other faculty involved directly. I think it would tend to be mostly us, and I'm probably insulting some others that had a role, but not maybe as dramatically. And so the goal was, can we achieve the same, or better, ideally, level of education? In other words, some measuring of what someone is learning without the focus on grades and you've got to go to this particular classroom or whatever. Again, none of that's totally unique. I mean, there's, very traditional professors who say, I don't care if you come into my lectures. You can pass the test, fine. So the main experience of all that, besides what I'd call the countercultural element to it, which was important at the time, was that it was a much greater burden on the students. I think they came to realize that, which freedom is a very, very difficult thing. And most of us, while we say we want it, would love others to make our decisions for us. And so I think for all the students, that was a real challenge. And for many of the students who were very capable, it was a really great experience. For others, it was a real struggle, because if I don't have to necessarily go to that class, or if I don't have to do it this way, I've got to decide for myself how I'm going to achieve these ends. That's tough. Wonderful experience, but very, very tough.
What other options did students have if they didn't attend class? What other things could they do?
Well, the goal of this is that they were to, with their colleagues, their fellow students, and with the faculty, which I think was mostly Crosby and I, they were to create their own plan. And that's what was so difficult. In other words, we weren't saying, well, just don't go to class. I mean, if you're not going to go to class and you're interested in history, I don't want to emphasize not going to class because that really wasn't too relevant. It was more like, how are you going to achieve the goals that you want to go, that you want? How are you going to be knowledgeable so that you could be passing these tests, that you really could be knowledgeable about 20th century U.S. history, for example? And so they would, it's kind of like independent study and tutorials, you know, they would set some of their own goals and they would set projects and they would have to present those projects to the whole group. And then the group would have kind of collective criticism of your peers as well as the faculty. And then there's where they bring in, when I said other faculty, there's where they bring in other faculty, because maybe one of the students was doing an elaborate thing with Mary Griffin. Okay, so then Mary Griffin would be brought into this analysis. And then one of the most exciting things is at the end of the year, okay, or at the end of the term or whatever, they would have to be putting on these demonstrations. You know, one of the students was an artist, and so obviously her final presentation was artwork. Others were English, and so then something that they had written about. Others were, you know, social studies, social science type students that had done some sort of experiment. And, you know, that was a lot of pressure on that. And then you had this, again, the goal was for people to be setting their own agenda with criticism from caring individuals, their colleagues in this experiment, as well as the faculty. It was the kind of thing that worked particularly well for some of the students who, let's say, had a good grounding. I think it was more difficult, let's say, for a freshman to join, who wouldn't quite admit it. You know, for some are joining, might even know they want to be cool. And so some of the students had a hard time because they would give us the excuses of, well, I want to set my own agenda, blah, blah, blah. And in some cases, you're just trying to avoid facing up to the fact that you don't write well enough. Okay. The difference was that you had a smaller collective group that you could deal with in a freer atmosphere. Okay, you didn't have to necessarily meet at 9:30 in the morning. You could all meet at 4 in the afternoon and go for 2 hours or whatever. So it was a good experiment. I think it worked for most students. I think, like I say, that the drawbacks were those students who were perhaps not as grounded and couldn't deal with the freedom because maybe they didn't have the core. But, you know, I remember you mentioned a guy. I mean, one of the students who we gave a hard time with that. This was probably the third or fourth year. I don't know how long it lasted, but it wasn't in the first one or two. But I think all those students have turned out pretty successful. I wish we could go back. But one of them who was kind of problematic was a guy named Mueller, I'm sorry if I'm butchering his name. And Les was a character, and we all gave Les a hard time. Come on, Les, Les has now gone on to get various psychiatric degrees. He's just done very well. And the guy's a bright guy who learned a lot, but he was trying to escape, which meant he couldn't deal with discipline as well as he should have. But, you know, he came around. And that's just something I just love to know, how these students came out and what many of them actually felt about it. Because I think most of them would have good feelings. Some would have mixed feelings. Some would say, well, you know, I know I learned some things, but I might have been better off if I just was in a rigid situation, too. So I think most of us realize that real education is some blend of the creative and the, you know, finding your own direction, as well as just good old-fashioned, hey, I want to listen to this professor because, man, I can learn a lot just listening to him.
It offered, it seems, a non-traditional way to earn a degree or to qualify for a degree. How did students in the more, I guess, mainstream curriculum at Mundelein view the experimental college?
Well, I guess I have no way of knowing. I don't know that we did surveys. My guess is, and it's just a guess, is you had a variety of things. Some probably, many didn't even pay much attention. Those that did probably had a variety of views. We're thinking, oh, those lucky stiffs in some ways, and others saying, no, I don't want to be part of that. And I think part of it would have been the notion, like I said, it's a countercultural. I think they would have said, oh, those are the students that are, again, I don't know the words, it was perceived as a radical experiment. You got to understand, early 70s, again, it's a countercultural time. Crosby is a long-haired, very long-haired, full-bearded professor, always seen as what you might say a maverick. At Mundelein for lots of different reasons. I was very young. I guess my hair was much longer than, not as long as Crosby's, but, you had that. You had some of the students who were the more free-spirited students. So my guess there was some of that. But, what the heck are they doing? Some with envy, some with disdain. But I don't remember much that was, that people just do your thing. So if there was a lot of thought, I wasn't fully aware of it, but I wouldn't be surprised if what I'm describing was more, it had less reaction to, is someone really learning this or not, but it's more like, who is this group that maybe sits out in the lawn looking like a bunch of hippies? You know what I mean? I think that probably affected thought more than the quality of someone's project or work that they're actually doing.
You mentioned before a strike, I think, on campus. Was that related to the anti-war movement?
Yeah, it was a very, for me, a very exciting time. Like, I came full-time the fall of 69, and that's when there was the, in terms of the Vietnam War, that many campuses were really getting active. Mundelein.